This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup, a wrap-up of the week with background and analysis from the correspondents who cover the news. And now from Washington, here's CBS News national correspondent Dan Rabin.
Was the deal with Iran a good one? The first negotiated limits on that country's nuclear program. But did Iran get too much for giving too little? We'll hear various views on that, including from the U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, who made the deal in Geneva. And later, the weather worries in the run-up to Thanksgiving. A storm system noticed at the start of the week in the southwest before moving out to the east and north. You'll hear CBS's Anna Werner in Dallas.
Parts of West Texas got as much as 5 inches of snow. Nearly 500 flights were canceled at Dallas-Fort Worth Airport.
The Supreme Court will consider the appeal by a company that it should not be forced by Obamacare to pay for its employees' birth control. We'll hear CBS News correspondent Barry Bagnato.
A key question here is, do companies have the same religious rights as individuals?
And a lot more on this weekend roundup. But first, last weekend, on Saturday night, President Obama addressed the nation from the White House because a deal had been reached with Iran after what was then revealed to be months of secret contacts, then negotiations in Geneva, Switzerland that involved six nations on one side and Iran on the other. The result, an agreement designed to last 6 months, to be replaced by a longer-lasting arrangement if negotiations are successful next year. For now, putting some limits on uranium enrichment and stopping construction of what could be a plutonium facility in Iran with a lot more inspections. In exchange, Iran gets access to money frozen in bank accounts, an estimated $8 billion, and Iran claims the world now recognizes that Iran has the right to enrich uranium for what are claimed to be peaceful purposes. Here's CBS News chief White House correspondent Major Garrett.
The White House got to work almost immediately on the next phase of these talks, the ones designed to end, not merely halt, Iran's nuclear weapons program. At President Obama's invitation, Israel's national security advisor will travel to Washington next week to play a key role in those negotiations. Facing skepticism from Congress and Israel, President Obama defended the deal with Iran as a victory for diplomacy over war.
We cannot close the door on diplomacy, and we cannot rule out peaceful solutions to the world's problems. We cannot commit ourselves to an endless cycle of conflict. And tough talk and bluster may be the easy thing to do politically, but it's not the right thing for our security.
I do think it was the sanctions and the threat of military action that brought the Iranians to the table.
New York Congressman Elliot Engel, top Democrat on the Foreign Affairs Committee and author of a new set of tougher sanctions against Iran, wants the White House to keep up the pressure.
The Iranians are still talking about how this agreement won them the right to enrich. They don't have the right to enrich, and we need to make it very clear to them.
Just after the last session of talks ended in Geneva at around 3 a.m. European time last Sunday, Secretary of State John Kerry told CBS News there are reasons to be skeptical about the Iranians.
You don't have to trust the people you're dealing with. You have to have a mechanism put in place whereby you know exactly what you're getting and you know exactly what they're doing. And we believe we are at the beginning of putting that in place with Iran.
I'm Robert Berger in Jerusalem. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says the deal does not dismantle Iran's capability to build a nuclear bomb, and therefore it's a historic mistake.
Israel has many friends and allies, but when they're mistaken, it's my obligation to speak out clearly and openly and say so.
He said the world's most dangerous regime, Iran, has taken a significant step toward obtaining the world's most dangerous weapons.
Israel is not bound by this agreement. We cannot and will not allow a regime that calls for the destruction of Israel to obtain the means to achieve this goal. We will not allow Iran to have a nuclear weapons capability.
Netanyahu said Israel is prepared to defend itself by itself, a broad hint that an Israeli preemptive strike on Iran's nuclear facilities remains an option.
That from CBS News correspondent Robert Berger in Jerusalem. Interviewed by USA Today, U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel, a former Republican senator, said there are some risks involved in the deal with Iran, but the risks to the U.S., he said, are not large, and it's worth it, said Hagel. Let's turn to CBS News national security analyst Juan Zarate. There are many elements to weigh in considering whether the deal with Iran was a good thing.
Well, Dan, I think the first question is, does it achieve the initial goal, which is to pause the Iranian nuclear program for additional talks and diplomacy to happen, to get to that agreed long-term comprehensive solution that the administration and the other powers want to get to with Iran? And so, in a sense, this deal starts to get there. The problem is, and the risk, is that there are elements of this that certainly don't stop Iran's enrichment program itself, doesn't guarantee its dismantlement, and certainly doesn't assure that the Iranians are going to make a fair and complete deal in 6 months' time. And so there are risks to this. But I think the Obama administration has decided it's a risk worth taking.
One thing Kerry said is that the alternative would have been no deal. I guess that's true once you've decided to negotiate with Iran, break the ice, have some decent relations after more than 30 years of not speaking between the U.S. and Iran.
I think the challenge here is whether or not the U.S. has a framework and an end state in mind that it's driving toward. The Iranians are good negotiators. They have in the past negotiated not only for time, but for greater flexibility on their nuclear program. And I think a key question for critics of this deal is whether or not we're giving up too much leverage too soon. The sanctions and the international pressure and isolation has in many ways brought the Iranians to the table. And the question is, have we released that leverage and the financial pressure valve too quickly and too soon? And have we cashed in too quickly before the final comprehensive deal is made?
Is it a terrific breakthrough that international inspectors will have the right to go every day to two of the facilities in Iran?
Well, it is helpful, but as we know, the IAEA, the inspectors, are negotiating still with Iran for access to other sites as well. And so what is left out of this deal is potentially more problematic. That is, sites like Parshan or the military sites where the Iranians have yet to allow inspectors in. That's really where you then have the question as to what the Iranians are up to and where a lot of the mistrust and suspicion lies.
A lot of our listeners may wonder, bottom line, Juan, has the deal in Geneva reduced the chances of another Middle East war?
Well, at least in the short term, it guarantees that you're not going to see at least movement toward war or conflict. But keep in mind, there are all sorts of variables at play. Certainly the Israelis are watching this very carefully, mistrustful of the Iranians. I doubt highly that anything will happen in the next 6 months. And so this interim deal, at a minimum, I think has cooled tensions and has allowed a space for further talks.
CBS News national security analyst Juan Zarate. Thank you, Juan.
Thank you, Dan.
Up next, a fierce storm. Not a good thing when preparing a holiday meal for family flying or driving your way.
Stay with us on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's Dan Ravine.
As the holiday Thanksgiving approached, it was no surprise that bad weather was high in the headlines. Millions of Americans were heading home or wherever their holiday feast would be. So as airlines and airports, especially along the East Coast, braced for wind, rain, and in some places cold, CBS's Anna Werner reported how bad it was at the start of the week in Texas.
Parts of West Texas got as much as 5 inches of snow, but it was ice that caused the most travel problems. Nearly 500 flights were canceled at Dallas-Fort Worth Airport. Evan Van Doren was trying to get to Indiana.
I would look forward to Thanksgiving all year long, so having a day cut off this trip is not the best thing in the world for me.
Icy conditions crept east into Oklahoma, causing this SUV to flip over and a 12-car pileup in Arkansas. The mayhem kept Tommy Easterling and his wrecking service busy.
People just don't realize when they cross those bridges that they've got ice on them, and when they cross it, they lose it.
But the same system was a welcome holiday boost for ski areas in Colorado. They expect their best season in 6 years.
That from CBS's Anna Werner in Dallas. The Supreme Court justices have decided to hear arguments about the health reform law, specifically the requirement that birth control be covered by medical insurance policies. Some companies and organizations on religious grounds are objecting that they don't want to be forced by Obamacare to pay for something that violates their beliefs. As CBS's Barry Bagnato reports,
In one of the most closely watched challenges, Hobby Lobby, a company run by a Christian family, says it should not be forced to provide emergency contraception that it considers a form of abortion.
This is a core teaching of large and mainstream religious groups, and it's part of the president's principal domestic policy initiative. So we got very high stakes.
University of Virginia law professor Douglas Laycock. A key question here is, do companies have the same religious rights as individuals? Barry Bagnato, CBS News, Washington.
CBS News senior legal analyst Andrew Cohen told us,
the reason so many people expected the court to hear these cases, why so many people are right, is that there is now a split at the lower court level. Some of those lower federal judges have declared this contraception mandate under the CARE Act to be constitutional, and some judges haven't. And, of course, the justices in Washington want to break the tie. There are actually two cases the justices have agreed to hear on the topic. One is a straight constitutional case. Does the Affordable Care Act violate the free exercise of religion clause of the First Amendment? And the other case is under a federal statute designed to protect religious liberties. It's a law called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act.
During President Obama's West Coast trip in the days before Thanksgiving, he spoke at Democratic Party fundraisers and at some public events. At one, as correspondent Nora O'Donnell reported on CBS This Morning, the president was interrupted and got in some verbal back and forth.
In San Francisco Monday, the president was interrupted by a heckler during his remarks on immigration reform. A member of the audience, Ju Hung, spoke up in the middle of the president's speech. Hung is an undocumented South Korean immigrant who attends UC Berkeley. He challenged the president's deportation policy.
That's why we're here.
President, please use your executive order to halt deportations for all 11.5 undocumented immigrants in this country right now. You have a power to stop deportation for all of that.
Actually, I don't. And that's why we're here.
I need your help.
Okay.
Stop deportation!
Thank you. All right.
An interesting moment there, and the president is calling on House Republicans to act on immigration reform by the end of this year.
That was in San Francisco on Monday. Now to Newtown, Connecticut, where a massacre took place in Sandy Hook Elementary School in mid-December last year. The state attorney's office has released a detailed report on the murders of 20 children and 6 adults in the school, saying Adam Lanza did it alone, not telling anybody his plan. And that morning at home, he murdered his mother using guns that she had purchased legally. More from CBS News correspondent Elaine Quijano.
The report provides new details about Lanza's life, including a preoccupation with mass shootings, in particular the Columbine shootings, a spreadsheet with mass murders over the years listing information about each shooting. Investigators also found a computer game titled School Shooting and images of Lanza holding a handgun to his head. Before the shooting, Lanza's mother, Nancy, became concerned that her son hadn't gone anywhere in 3 months and would only communicate with her by email. The report also addressed Lanza's mental health, saying he was diagnosed with Asperger's in 2005 and was described by doctors who treated him as presenting with significant social impairments and extreme anxiety. It was also noted that he lacked empathy. But those doctors did not see anything that would have predicted his future behavior.
Authorities say they don't know why Lanza attacked the school and murdered kids in cold blood, but the state attorney added it's now case closed. In Steubenville, Ohio, a rape case that got a lot of news coverage early this year is reopened in a way with criminal charges against 4 adults alleged to have covered up what they knew about the assault by 2 high school boys who were convicted of raping a 16-year-old girl. In Steubenville, CBS News correspondent Michelle Miller says investigators interviewed 123 witnesses, and that led to additional charges against additional defendants.
In March, Malik Richmond and his teammate Trent Mays were convicted of rape and sentenced to at least a year in juvenile jail. Monday, Ohio Attorney General Mike DeWine announced the indictment of 4 others, 4 adults.
How do you hold kids accountable if you don't hold the adults accountable?
The school superintendent, Michael McVeigh, faces felony charges, including tampering with evidence and obstructing justice. 2 coaches there have also been indicted for lesser charges, and an elementary school principal is charged with failing to report child abuse in an earlier case. If McVeigh is convicted on all counts, DeWine says he could face up to 5 years and 270 days in prison.
We have adults in this situation who, it seems, were more concerned about protecting certain things and certain people than they were about protecting a victim.
That from CBS's Michelle Miller in Steubenville, Ohio. In Oakland, California, a man hailed as an angel insists he's not a hero. 61-year-old Donnie Navidad says his military instincts as an ex-Marine prompted him to take action when he was in Raiders Stadium last Sunday attending an NFL game and saw a woman in the seats high above him was thinking about suicide. She did jump. He broke her fall. Navidad has severe bruises. She was reported in critical condition after plunging 45 feet and bouncing off him.
I didn't position myself to actually beat her to grab her. I just happened to be there. And when my coworker said she was falling, I just reacted the way I did. I just want to put out that I'm not a hero. I just reacted the way I did.
Donnie Navidad in Oakland, who wanted to save a life. He didn't run away when that woman jumped. Up next, Afghanistan and Syria. Then we'll talk about Teddy Roosevelt.
Stay with us on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's Dan Revie.
There's an old adage that it's easy to start a war, but hard to end one. When it came to Iraq, where the United States had wanted to keep some troops on counterterrorism missions, and frankly to balance the growing power of the neighboring country, Iran, negotiations with the Iraqi government failed. No agreement protecting U.S. soldiers, for instance, from prosecution by Iraqi courts, so the Americans left. In Afghanistan, a security agreement has been negotiated, but it seemed to be falling apart. So President Obama's National Security Advisor, Susan Rice, flew to Kabul and started conferring with the Afghan government. Rice also visiting U.S. troops in various parts of Afghanistan to praise their service at Thanksgiving time. CBS's Elizabeth Palmer reports from London.
President Hamid Karzai and the U.S. National Security Advisor posed for local Afghan cameras, looking cordial. But behind the smiles, there's a deadlock. Susan Rice believed the two countries had a security deal that would keep about 8,000 U.S. troops in Afghanistan after the official pullout next year. But at the last minute, Karzai refused to sign.
If the agreement isn't signed promptly, what I said to the president is we would have no choice. We would be compelled by necessity, not by our preference, to have to begin to plan for the prospect that we will not be able to keep our troops here.
A grand council of elders and politicians from across Afghanistan approved the deal to leave U.S. and NATO troops in country after 2014. But President Karzai suddenly overruled them, saying he won't sign unless the U.S. meets a series of conditions that includes a commitment that U.S. soldiers would no longer enter any Afghan homes on military operations.
Elizabeth Palmer on Afghanistan, still problematic, and tens of thousands of Americans are still fighting Islamic radicals there. In Syria, the civil war has been raging for almost 3 years. The number of dead, more than 120,000, according to the UN. The Obama administration says President Bashar al-Assad should be removed from power, but the U.S. does not support the rebels who are believed to be linked with al-Qaeda. The U.S. and allies do give some limited aid to pro-Western rebel groups. Let's hear part of what's going on in the Syrian capital, Damascus, supported by the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. Reese Ehrlich was there.
At a holy shrine in Damascus, an imam chants prayers to celebrate a Shia Muslim holiday. The Ruqayya Shrine and many other places in Syria are guarded by Hezbollah, the Lebanese Shia militia, now fighting to keep the Syrian government in power. Abu Hamdi is an official at the Ruqayya Shrine.
Hezbollah.
Hamdi says most security is from Syrian troops, but Hezbollah fighters are here to help protect the shrine. The participation of Hezbollah fighters, along with militias from Iraq, indicates the difficulties faced by the Syrian government of Bashar al-Assad as it battles well-armed rebels on the outskirts of Damascus. During the interview, artillery fire can be heard in the background, and a high-powered rifle shot suddenly rings out. The Syrian government nevertheless maintains it's winning the war. Syria's Minister of Justice, Najm al-Ahmad, says the country's major cities are nearly all back in the government camp after more than a year of being under rebel control. He says in some pockets in rural areas, there are attacks on Damascus, but the Syrian army is achieving good progress in all areas of the country. But recently, a rebel bomb killed 150 government troops at an army vehicle depot on the northern outskirts of Damascus. Rebels had dug a 50-foot deep tunnel under the building and then set off explosives, demonstrating a high level of expertise. Justice Minister Ahmad doesn't expect the rebels to negotiate a political settlement in Geneva if talks ever get started there. He predicts the war will continue. He says, if the opposition goes to Geneva, that's good. If they go or not, we will not stop fighting. Back at the Ruqayyah Shrine, men and boys continue their prayers. Abu Hamdi says that so far, rebel mortars have not hit this shrine. He says, we haven't been hit yet because we're out of range, but that could change any time. For the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Reese Ehrlich in Damascus for the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting.
Just an example of violence there in the capital. A suicide car bombing this past Tuesday killed 6 Syrian soldiers and 9 civilians in Damascus. But finally, there are some serious peace efforts. A conference to include government officials and at least some opposition groups is planned for Geneva January 22nd. That's what the United Nations is planning. Now let's talk about presidents of the United States just over one century ago. We'll speak with Doris Kearns Goodwin, the historian whose latest bestseller is titled The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. Let's talk about Teddy Roosevelt. He became president in September of 1901 when President William McKinley was assassinated. Roosevelt, of course, was his vice president. Was the country seeking change? Is that what he promised?
No, in fact, he was much more conservative at the beginning, and when he first took over, he was careful to stay in line with the traditional Republican legacy of not wanting regulation into social and economic problems, because he knew he needed the power of the bosses of the party behind him. But then gradually, he began to realize that unless the Republican Party began to deal with the social and economic problems, that socialism was on the agenda. There was anarchism, there was violence and labor strikes. So that's why he needed the bully pulpit, to mobilize the country to force an unwilling Congress to move forward.
Did he come up with that phrase?
Yes, he's the first person who ever used the phrase to define the national platform the president has to educate the country, to mobilize public sentiment.
President Roosevelt served 8 years, and in 1908, William Howard Taft was elected, again a Republican. You say they were friends, and Taft would have wanted to be like T.R.
Roosevelt handpicked him as his successor and helped to run his campaign, was constantly giving his advice. Taft was never as much of a fighter as was Roosevelt, and Taft got in hoping to carry out Roosevelt's legacy, and Teddy goes off to Africa for the year, comes back, and his progressive friends tell him Taft has become more conservative and is betraying his legacy, and their relationship begins to fall apart to the point where Teddy decides to run against him in 1912, and of course that's a huge, ugly fight in 1912 that makes the Civil War in the Republican Party now seem very mild, and of course they split the vote because Teddy goes to a third party. They win a majority together, but Woodrow Wilson, the Democrat, wins as a result of the split in the party.
An uproarious time chronicled in this book, The Bully Pulpit. It's about Theodore Roosevelt, it's about William Howard Taft, but also about what Doris Kearns Goodwin calls the golden age of journalism. Doris Kearns Goodwin, best of luck. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Please follow us on Twitter for the latest headlines at CBS Radio News, and I'm at Dan Ravine.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup, a wrap-up of the week with the correspondents who cover the news. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's correspondent Dan Ravine.
Shopping can be fun or stressful, but it's a big part of the holiday season, and electronics, including toys, sell especially well as Thanksgiving passes, Hanukkah has begun, and Christmas is less than a month away. Let's turn to Larry Magid, tech analyst for CNET and CBS News. What are folks buying?
Well, I guess it depends on their budgets. There'll be some people that are going to buy big screen TVs. Some people will buy expensive digital cameras. But I think a lot of people are going to be looking for relatively inexpensive gifts this holiday season. It could be something like an external hard drive for $79 that can store a terabyte of data, which is a lot of data. It could be a case for your smartphone or maybe a case for your tablet or your laptop, starting at probably under $10. Or it could be a laptop or an e-reader. Amazon's got some good deals on Kindles and Kindle Fires that are tablets, e-readers. You can even watch video on them. So there are plenty of things out there. One of the things that I'm hoping to get this holiday season is something like the Fitbit, which is a wristwatch-like device that'll keep track of my exercise, monitor my calories, even monitor my sleep. All of this will be projected to my smartphone or my PC. So after those holiday dinners, maybe I can get back in shape.
And at your website, larrysworld.com, you're writing a lot about tablets, including the new ones from Apple, but also, well, frankly, cheaper ones that are Android devices.
There are great Apple models out there. I love the iPad Air. I love the iPad Mini, but they're pricey. And I happen to have a Nexus 7, which I think costs about $229. It's made for Google. It's got Google's name on it. And I like it. It does pretty much everything that the iPad does, but for less money. And money's important to people.
Sure it is, but it's the season to spend it. So some people are buying the game consoles from Xbox and PlayStation. Is there really anything new about them?
These are real improvements over the predecessors, especially in terms of their living room connectivity. The Xbox is really a living room hub. It recognizes you when you walk in the door. You can make phone calls on it. You can have videos on it. And you can stream video to watch your Netflix or your HBO Go or your other video. So these are great living room add-ons, even if you're not a gamer.
That's Larry Magid, CBS News and CNET tech analyst. Happy holidays, and thank you, Larry.
Happy holidays to you, Dan.
Now to Rome. At the Vatican, bones believed to be those of St. Peter have been put on display for the first time in front of St. Peter's Basilica. CBS News correspondent Alan Pizzi was watching last Sunday as Pope Francis held a chest containing the bone fragments.
The bones were found during an 11-year excavation under the St. Peter's Basilica that began in 1939. They were close to some graffiti in ancient Greek that was interpreted as "Peter is here." The mass at which they were displayed for the first time marked the end of the year of the faith. One reason they were kept hidden for so long is an ongoing debate over whether or not the bones really are St. Peter's. Scientific tests conducted on the 9 bone fragments, now resting in a jewel box inside a bronze case, showed only that they belonged to a robust man who died in his 60s. No pope has definitively declared that they do belong to St. Peter, but in 1968, Pope Paul VI said they had been identified in a way we believe to be convincing. The man considered to be the first pope was crucified in the year 64 AD on the site where the basilica built in his name now stands. Venerating his relics is an integral part of the Catholic faith, according to Father Gino Silve of Paterson, New Jersey.
We adore God. We worship God. We reverence God. We honor the saints. And that's what veneration is.
That from CBS's Alan Pizzi in Rome. Have you noticed a new movie starring the great British actress Judi Dench? It's called Philomena, based on a true story of a BBC correspondent who helped an Irish woman search for her lost child here in Washington, D.C. CBS's Elizabeth Palmer in London has met the real mom who went through all that, finding her son who'd been adopted and grew up in the U.S., Philomena Lee.
Back in 1951, in conservative Catholic Ireland, she got pregnant. Her father threw her out, and she went in disgrace to stay with the nuns at Shawnross Abbey in Tipperary, who ran a home for unwed mothers and their babies. To understand, she said, you have to picture how repressed Ireland was in the early 50s and how ignorant young women, especially those educated by the nuns, were about sex. When she got pregnant, Philomena, who was 19 at the time, was staying with her aunt.
She took me to a carnival. Well, I'd never seen a carnival in my whole life. And I thought, oh, my goodness gracious. Because I'd just not long left the school, convent school. And this John came over, sauntering over, chattering, and we ended up having a romantic evening. So I didn't know the first thing about sex. Didn't know what I'd done or anything.
So you never saw him again?
Never. She wouldn't let me out. She locked me in.
And could you write him a note explaining what happened?
Well, I couldn't. I couldn't get out to write to him.
Because she didn't want you to see a boy?
Yeah, she didn't want me to see the boy, you see. And I didn't know I was pregnant myself until a few months later. She must have noticed me getting big. And she said, are you pregnant? I said, well, what's pregnant? I was that ignorant. She said, have you been with the boy? I said, yeah, that John that we met. But she said, I said, you wouldn't let me out to meet him.
And then it was off to the nuns.
And then it was straight away to the nuns. But my father nearly went crazy. He used to tell my elder sister Mary, she's dead. I don't want her mentioned, you know. Don't want anything. Didn't know what the heck we'd done, you know, when I had to say I was pregnant.
Such a harsh time when you think back.
Oh, it's awful. And I look back and think about it. People wouldn't believe that today. Being brought up with nuns, we never knew what sex was, never saw boys.
The nuns actually ran that convent specifically for young unwed mothers.
Yes.
Philomena gave birth to a son, Anthony, at the Abbey, but 3 years later the boy was given away for adoption to a wealthy American couple. Philomena never forgot him. But over the decades, in spite of her searching for him, and he, as an adult, searching for her, the nuns did their best to make sure the two never found each other.
Well, you know, when I left the home, after Anthony went, and after I left the home, I went to Liverpool. They got me a job in a boys' school. And then I worked there for 2 years, and I became very bitter. I became so bitter. I didn't go to Mass. I didn't go to confession.
Why did the nuns not want him to find you? What was that all about?
I don't know. I just don't know. Since the film was made, there's a lot of women like me are coming out and trying to find them, and they're still having difficulties. They're not telling them anything, you know.
Now 80, and something of a celebrity herself, Philomena says she's thrilled that her story's been told, and even more thrilled to have been played on the big screen by the great actress Judi Dench.
Somebody like Judi Dench doing my story. It's unbelievable.
Philomena Lee, the movie Philomena, is based on what she went through finding her son in the U.S. Coming up, we'll talk about American couples who go overseas when they can't have a baby. They find surrogate mothers.
Stay with us on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's correspondent Dan Rabee.
Though Israel's a very small country, population 8 million, it's often in the headlines this past week for objecting to the deal that the U.S. and other nations made with Iran to limit Iran's nuclear program while sanctions are eased. Let's get a wider view of Israeli attitudes from Yossi Klein Halevi. Born in Brooklyn, but he moved to Israel and lives there. Now the author of a book called Like Dreamers, tracing what happened to the idealistic Israeli soldiers who captured East Jerusalem in the Six-Day War in 1967. Dreaming only good things, yet when it comes to captured or occupied territories, Israel has had 46 years of controversy, some violence, and some peace negotiations. Yossi Klein Halevi, some of those paratroops in 1967 are on the cover of your book.
What I find so moving about that iconic photograph is the innocence and the wonder in their faces, and they have no clue about what they're about to open up.
Now, what you did as a journalist and historian is find them, not just the three that I see on the front cover. How many of the paratroopers did you find?
Well, I focus on seven men who fought in the Battle of Jerusalem and then proceeded to become leaders of either the right-wing West Bank settlement movement or the left-wing anti-settlement peace movement.
You're saying they could have gone either way?
And they did.
Activists or militants, you might say.
Exactly. This book, in a way, is a biography of Israel's soul. What happened to Israel, the people of Israel, as a result of the Six-Day War?
When it comes to Israeli-Palestinian peace talks now being sponsored by the U.S., the book suggests that Israelis are united about that.
Partly that's by default. When you look at what's happening in the region, one country after another on our borders is imploding. And so Israelis realize that arguments about war and peace and territories are a little bit theoretical at this point. So there is a consensus of sorts that's emerged that if we can make peace, we would. And given the fact that at the moment the Middle East isn't capable of even making peace with itself, let alone with a Jewish state in its midst, we've suspended, at least for now, our internal arguments.
What about most of your countrymen and countrywomen? Have they actually lost interest in the conflict with the Arabs or the chances of peace with the Palestinians? And Israelis just want to have a good time at the beach, make money for their family, go on foreign trips?
I think that that is what one sees on a superficial level. But if you go a little bit deeper, you realize that Israelis have a coping strategy which has gotten us through 7 wars in the last 50 years, endless terror attacks, numerous waves of immigration, and the coping mechanism is one day at a time. If there were really a chance at this point to make peace with a Palestinian leadership that could deliver on an agreement, then my sense is upwards of 70% of Israelis would sign on the agreement, even if it meant withdrawing from the territories, uprooting settlements, even if it meant redividing Jerusalem, which is really in the starting point of my story.
That's in the book titled Like Dreamers, the story of the Israeli paratroopers who reunited Jerusalem and divided a nation. That's the author Yossi Klein Halevi. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Let's talk about surrogacy. Yes, it's a way of having a baby if you can't. If you're a couple, there's some medical problem, some reason that you can't naturally, biologically have your own child. You could hire someone to have the baby for you. Let's explore that with an author who has explored everything about it, Leslie Morgan Steiner, a well-known journalist, a best-selling author. Your latest book is called The Baby Chase: How Surrogacy is Transforming the American Family. And you're focused mainly on a couple in Arizona that felt they couldn't have a child, and so they did hire a woman in India to have the baby for them. But how do you do that? I mean, who's actually the father? How did that work?
What's different about surrogacy today is that the sperm comes from one source, the egg comes from another, and the uterus is completely separate from both of them.
So the Indian woman who gives birth to the child in your story, it's not even her ovum or egg.
Exactly. She's not genetically, biologically related to the child that she carried for the couple from Arizona, Rhonda and Jerry Weil.
So some would say, you know, in a joking way, oh, I see a womb for rent, ha ha. But it's really not funny when it comes to India, where I assume the fees involved is probably life-changing in India.
It is, and arguably it's life-changing in the United States, too. Surrogates in the U.S. get paid a very huge amount of money. It can cost $100,000 to hire a surrogate in the U.S. And that's why Rhonda and Jerry Weil had to go to India, because she's a nurse and he's a firefighter, and they couldn't afford that.
People may wonder, what does it cost? I mean, we're talking about $20,000 or so for the whole thing, or more than that?
Jerry and Rhonda Weil had 3 kids in India. And in the United States, it would have cost about $300,000 to do that via surrogacy. In India, it cost them more like about $35,000, including the travel to India.
They didn't meet this Indian woman on their own. There was some go-between. You describe it's a clinic in Mumbai.
There is a clinic in Mumbai called Surrogacy India that is 100% devoted to helping infertile, mostly foreigners, but some Indian nationals too, hire Indian women to gestate babies for them.
You mentioned the sperm comes from the father. Usually, would the egg or the ovum come from the wife?
Everybody's first preference is to have a child that is completely biologically their child. But in this particular case, and in many cases, there's a problem with the eggs. There's almost never a problem with sperm. Eggs are tricky and complicated. So in this case, not only could Rhonda Weil not carry a baby because there was a problem with her uterus, but there were problems with her eggs too. So they actually bought eggs from a Muslim woman in India separate from the surrogate.
What are the downsides, including maybe just kind of prejudices that people have?
I think the whole idea of hiring somebody else to have a baby is really strange to just about everybody. Also, there is a huge potential for fraud and corruption here, because you have, on the one hand, couples that are desperate for a baby and will probably do anything to have a baby. And then on the other hand, you have women who are vulnerable in their own way, either because they need money that they earn as surrogates, and also sometimes they become kind of delusional themselves. They think they're doing such a good thing for other people, making somebody family dream come true, that they're vulnerable in a way too.
By the way, is there something about Indian law that means that the woman who gives birth has no legal claim over the baby in case she kind of changes her mind?
It's the same in the United States, too, that once you have signed a contract to be a surrogate in a state or a country that allows surrogacy, then that is not your baby anymore.
And some states in the U.S. don't permit it?
There are 10 states plus the District of Columbia that currently do not recognize paid commercial surrogacy.
But just to clarify, if I lived, say, in New York, I could hire a surrogate elsewhere in a legal state or even in India.
And there are surrogacy agencies in the United States, mostly in California, but there's some in Maryland and Pennsylvania and other surrogacy-friendly states that all the time have clients traveling long distances to have babies in their states and then take them back to their home state or home country.
Leslie Morgan Steiner, the author of The Baby Chase, How Surrogacy is Transforming the American Family. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Hope you're having a great Thanksgiving holiday weekend. And anytime you want to hear us, please do a web search for CBS Weekend Roundup. You'll find our podcasts also on iTunes and other podcast services. And our app for your smartphone is CBS Radio News. I'm Dan Revive. Bye.
You've been listening to the CBS News Weekend Roundup. The program is produced in the Washington Bureau of CBS News. The executive producer is Howard Arenstein.